Gonorrhea is still today the second leading sexually transmitted infection in the United States. And as a result, it's something that's important to pay attention to because this infection can lead to a variety of complications. The superbug aspect is the concern that the antibiotics that we used previously are no longer effective.
There were reports that it had gotten into the United States. There have since been reports saying that's not true, at least with this strain called HO41. Is that it?
Yeah.
But there were reports of about, what, H11S8, and there had been some cases in Hawaii.
So the way to understand that is to take a step back and look at street-level epidemiology. You know, how do you get the information? Because typically if somebody ends up having this kind of an infection, they aren't showing up and, you know, dialing into a website or phone number and saying, yeah, please study me. So instead what happens is when people get identified, it can be confusing when you read the reports because everyone's trying to follow it. And so the original cases of resistant gonorrhea, and let me pause for a second. Resistant means that this kind of infection, there are no pills that can treat it. The only way to treat it is with intravenous medicines or intramuscular medicines. In other words, a shot. And the initial reports actually came from the Far East, sort of Japan. And then what the epidemiologists do is, recognizing the potential importance of this, they then heighten surveillance in other areas. So we know that a lot of infectious diseases go from the Far East across the Pacific, Hawaii, West Coast, etc. And so then they start looking for that. And in fact, in World War II, that is how a lot of gonorrhea came to the United States, was that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important studies ever done on gonorrhea were done in Hawaii because of all the returning sailors. And there ends up being a political factor that gets thrown into this scientific mix because you have returning sailors. They're sick. They have a drip. Comes up with a variety of names, the clap, whatever. And then they infect their wives, and then their wives are unable to have children because of pelvic inflammatory disease and other complications from gonorrhea. Or alternatively, the wives end up birthing a child that then gets perinatal gonorrhea. And then everyone says, well, how did he get the gonorrhea? Well, he got the gonorrhea at the brothel in Tokyo when he was with MacArthur. And then everyone gets all mad. Because, well, no, of course he wouldn't have gone to a brothel. And then nobody wants to study it. And so we're kind of in the same situation. So I love it how people keep saying, oh, things are different. Actually, they're probably not. But now we have a bug, a germ that is so resourceful that it is mutating because we had been treating it with oral antibiotics for the last five
decades. And that
decades.
Was going to be my question as to how we got into this situation, because I thought gonorrhea was at a point where we could easily treat it, as you said, with pills.
Correct. So gonorrhea is very adaptable. And when you look at the spikes of gonorrhea, there was a huge spike of gonorrhea in the United States in the 1970s. When we actually didn't have good oral antibiotics. And then there was a tremendous innovation of good oral antibiotics. And then these were all used to treat gonorrhea. What happens is that gonorrhea cases get missed. They get missed because the individual patient doesn't present for medical attention. You get a gonorrhea infection, it doesn't kill you. It just makes you sick. And some individuals may be embarrassed. Healthcare professionals are frequently awkward about talking about this as well. And so the gonorrhea takes advantage of that because since it sometimes gets a delay in presentation or doesn't get presented, and then that individual may have taken antibiotics for other reasons, a bronchitis or whatever, and then the gonorrhea is able to mutate with those kinds of pressures.
So are we talking about a new strain of it that's worse than what we've seen before? As bad? What?
Well, the interesting concern is that when gonorrhea was first discovered and really described around World War II, penicillin always worked. And so those Navy boys were all treated with penicillin. And so when those second wave of soldiers started coming back, penicillin wasn't working. And so the initial innovation by the doctors in Hawaii was to increase the penicillin dose. Then they started finding penicillin resistance. Like, no matter how much penicillin you give, it didn't work. So that led to new antibiotic innovations.
Okay.
Now we're at a point over the last two decades where there have been very few antibiotic innovations. There's a lot of reasons for that. But it affects all of bacterial infections. We don't really have new antibiotics in the pipeline. Previously, it really was an arms race. You know, the germ would mutate. We would then adapt. We would kill the germ with new antibiotics. Then the germ would continue to mutate. We're not playing that game anymore. It's like we stopped participating in the arms race, and the germ is still mutating. So we're now looking at older antibiotics, antibiotics that might have been shelved because of side effects, or other antibiotics that we've never used before for gonorrhea that are only available in the hospital for patients who are in the intensive care unit with other kinds of infections. And it seems like some of those antibiotics may work, but this is not convenient outpatient medicine. This gets a lot more serious.
So what happens? What can be done about this?
Well,
are we falling so far behind that maybe the public has a real reason to get concerned about all of this?
There are two camps of thought when we talk about resistant bacteria. Some say that rather than increasing the size of the sledgehammer, you know, modifying the weapon further, that that is actually a losing battle because evolution will occur with the bacteria anyway, and they will develop resistance anyway. And so those say that we use too many antibiotics. Like, we need to reserve the antibiotics for those that are truly ill. Others would say that that's rationing of care, and that instead what we need to do is we need to give these people everything we can so that we can treat them. And that, in fact, we're not using enough antibiotics because it's the inadequate antibiotic individual cases where the bacteria can mutate.
Nobody is quite sure. There's just debate over what to do about it, but no answer has been reached.
There's a huge debate, but certainly what both camps agree on is that we are in an incredible desert of research and development when it comes to antibiotics. Basically, what happened was in the 1970s, the United States initiated a war on cancer. Everybody thought infections were dead. And in the 1980s, there were actually almost these kind of obituary type editorials. No one's going to have infections anymore. People don't die from infections. They only die from cancer and heart disease. So then there was a paradigm shift. Billions of dollars got moved from infectious diseases to other areas of research. And those decisions are what are affecting us today.
In the meantime, this strain of gonorrhea has not hit the United States yet, but is there reason to believe it's a matter of time before it happens?
Yes, because although on one hand, epidemics have the ability to surprise us almost in the random chaos, the way that you know, in hindsight, it makes sense. But the flip side is there are certain ways that epidemics like to flow based on the kind of epidemic or the kind of infection it is. Sexually transmitted infections, time and time again, always enter into the general public through the marginalized parts of society. That's been something that we've been seeing for hundreds of years. So King George III died from syphilis, some say. All right. Well, syphilis came from the Spanish explorers who brought it back to Western Europe, and then it slowly made its route. And although initially syphilis was something that was seen only in the lower socioeconomic status, well, now it got all the way up to the King of England. And that's time and time again what these sexually transmitted infections do. Because of the embarrassment associated with them, that puts them in the shadows, and it makes it harder to follow them. But the funny thing is they like to go the same way every time. So if you look at the inter-exchange that occurs between continents, we know, well, it happened before. Mm-hmm. Japan, Hawaii, Western United States, etc. And if they're picking it up in Hawaii, they're like, uh-oh, it's probably going to go. It's a short flight from Honolulu to Los Angeles. Just takes one person.
So all of that said, then, what can the public do to prevent further spread of gonorrhea?
Well, when we talk about sexually transmitted infections, mm-hmm. you know, if you hop onto Google and look up what does the CDC recommend or the state health department, and they'll give the common sense stuff that we were hearing back when HIV was attacking us. You know, abstinence is number one. Makes perfect sense. Even though it makes perfect sense, it's remarkable how hard it is for human beings to be abstinent. Number two, condoms help. It's remarkable how controversial a 5-cent piece of plastic can become because people say, well, you're supposed to be abstinent. Well, you can use condoms. And so that's the third, actually, element. It's like, all right, if we're going to talk about abstinence and if we're going to talk about, quote unquote, safe sex or condoms, then the third thing to talk about is leave your judgment at home. I mean, you don't need to be judgmental about somebody if, in fact, they have this condition, because that's what the infection almost kind of wants you to do. Because if you sit there and say, naughty, naughty, you got gonorrhea because you were a bad person, well, then that person's not going to present for care, and then they're going to be able to transmit the gonorrhea to other people.